My name is Erin Halligan, and I'm the conference director with Austin Film Festival. This year's conference is very exciting. Barry Josephson, Susan Sarandon, Jonathan Demme, and Kelly Curry. Vince Gilligan is going to be doing the Alpha and Omega episodes of Breaking Bad and a script reading of an unproduced script of his. We're very excited to have Will Ferrell, Thomas Hayden Church, and Linda Cardellini, Bo Willimon, who created House of Cards, Junji Cohen, who created Orange is the New Black, and Brian McGreevy and Lee Shipman, who created Hemlock Grove. We have Rob Thomas coming in. We have Gael Killen, who created Lone Star and Awake. Eli Addy will also be doing a West Wing versus House of Cards showdown with Bo Willimon. Shane Black, Robert Rodriguez, Brian Helgeland, Jim Taylor, Mark Johnson, Lee Wannell, Jeff Nichols, David Lowery, Scott Neustadter, and Richard Kelly, who hail from the Independent. I think this year's conference is unique in that it's very true to a lot of the trends in the industry that have emerged over the past year. Pay attention to what's happening with Netflix and the new release platform, including the changing landscape of television.
Go to AustinFilmFestival.com to find out more about the 20th annual Austin Film Festival, October 24th through the 31st, 2013. Today, on Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast, writer, director, and cinematographer Rodrigo Garcia.
You know, I'm still writing a movie. I need to see it. I mean, sometimes I'll put, you know, actors' faces even in my office just to see them. And, you know, it's always a pipe dream, of course, because you always go for the most exciting actor you could think of. And then sometimes that fucker will turn you down. But that hasn't happened to me.
Rodrigo Garcia has directed several award-winning independent films as well as episodes of many major television series, including 6 Feet Under, Carnival, and Big Love. He's also creator and writer of the wildly popular HBO series In Treatment, which is based on the Israeli television series Betty Pool. Garcia is the son of acclaimed Colombian writer Gabriel Garcia Marquez and thus grew up in the presence of other writers such as Carlos Fuentes, Pablo Neruda, and Luis Buñuel. Today's podcast was recorded in 2011 at the 18th Annual Austin Film Festival.
For a long time, people would ask me, you know, has your father influenced you? And, you know, it took me 10 years to 12 years or more to really answer the way I wanted to answer, which is, has your father influenced you? Has your mother influenced you? Do you know what I mean? So, especially, you know, someone like I said before, you know, for me, obsessed with, I mean, you know, there are writers and filmmakers, directors, screenwriters that I love and admire, of course. But, you know, I've had to just cut the crap. I mean, the people who have influenced me and influenced my work and the way I see the world are my parents, my children, my brother, my wife. You know, everything else is secondary or tertiary. I mean, it's just back there somewhere. So, you know, I grew up in an environment with my brother. We grew up in an environment in Mexico City that I think spanned two parts. There was a part when we were little, until I was 8 and my brother was 6. That's before my dad wrote 100 Years of Solitude. He worked as a screenwriter and he had published some books and we knew he was a writer. And there was always, you know, he would work with screenwriters in Mexico from Luis Alcoriza, Carlos Fuentes, etc. So, you know, two men sitting in the living room sort of discussing a story was something that we grew up in. You know, it looked like fun, I have to say, because it was just, it was conversation and they were either beating their head against the wall or thrilled by some breakthrough or, you know, and it was casual and sitting down and they were drinking. So it all looked like like it could be fun.
Getting paid, I hope, too.
And then, you know, after that, 100 Years of Solitude came out, and, you know, my dad became, you know, very famous. But this is pre-internet fame. This is before the media became completely grotesque. And this is even before TV was what it is, even remotely. So, you know, although my father was famous, and, you know, for example, I remember being 9, 10 years old, and I was aware that the high school kids in my class were reading his books. So I was aware of that, and it was mostly a period split between Mexico City and Barcelona. It was still a fairly middle-class life. You know, no one ever, you know, took my father's picture on the street. Many people didn't recognize him. You know, people's faces were not posted everywhere before. But so the real impact was the fact that the world was, you know, very cultured and literary. You know, all those guys, you know, Carlos Fuentes and Vargas Llosa, Pablo Neruda, Luis Buñuel. I mean, these are the people that, you know, I knew it from home, you know. So it was a very rich, they were all very, very unpretentious. I'm sure they were very creatively, very ambitious. You know, even then, no one was rich from writing. You know, some of these men made, or women made more money. But mostly you were an artist. And in fact, you know, commercial success was frowned upon. You know, in my house, the words bestseller were obscene. You know, I think my dad for a long time had a very conflicted relationship with 100 Years of Solitude because it sold so well and it appealed to everyone. And he distrusted the extremely high reception that it had. He mistrusted it just as much from high intelligentsia as he did from, you know, people buying the book in the supermarket who had no idea what it was. But anyway, it was, you know, everyone we knew was an artist who, while they made a living maybe working in an advertising agency, but, you know, we knew, I didn't know a single businessman growing up. And, you know, I did grow up in an environment where, as Bertolt Brecht said, starting a bank and robbing a bank were the same criminal. That's gone away, of course. That doesn't happen anymore.
Right. It's a different time now.
Well, my dad was a big still photography buff, what was then called, you know, street photography. You know, people like Cartier-Bresson and Robert Frank. And, you know, our house was full of books by those men. And he always very much, you know, admired them. So, you know, he had a camera. I took pictures. My brother also took a few. So black and white photography was my main hobby, as it were, in middle school and high school and then into college. But I was really sort of thinking of that as much as I was thinking of anything. I didn't really have a strong vocation for anything. But then after college, I started getting interested from still work to, you know, thinking about camera work. And so I did, you know, that whole thing you were talking about, which before used to be, you know, first you were an intern, then you were a camera PA, then a clapper loader, then a focus puller, then a camera operator, then a DP. So I spent, you know, a good 18 years or so, 17 years in that whole area coming up. And I for most of it, I never really thought I would be a director. You know, I was really, the dream was to be a cameraman. But yeah, little by little, it's just started getting into me. You know, there was a stretch where I was working on, I was shooting independent movies in L.A., but I was always working as a camera operator with Chivo Lubezki, who's a, you know, a great DP, a great cameraman from Mexico. And he was doing, you know, he was working in higher budget movies with very good directors. In particular, I mean, he worked with Cuarón, etc. But I remember a couple movies that I did, one directed by Robert Benton and one directed by Mike Nichols, where I think by then I had already started thinking that I was more interested in what was going on with the actors and the story and performance. And they were two directors who really have a very gentle touch and who really made it look easy. You know, for some reason, you know, I thought, hey, I could do this. You know, well, they're not doing anything, you know. And they were doing a lot, but, you know, that gentle approach, it sort of broke this idea for me that, you know, a director doesn't have to be General Patton and doesn't have to be a master of every single detail and every single idea has to come from him or her. It was just a very different way of working. So that's when I thought, okay, if I can write a screenplay, I'll direct it. That was my challenge to myself. I had this idea to tell stories about people in Los Angeles, and I always thought it would be made up of three or four or five stories. And they were going to be very, you know, realistic, contemporary, psychological. You know, they were influenced a lot by European film. So, you know, it'd be fair to say that they were all about, you know, people's anxiety and people living in isolation, etc. But they were still already, unbeknownst to me, about, you know, ties that bind. All the stories are about, you know, a woman and her son, two lovers, a couple that can't live without each other, you know, all that stuff. So I started writing. I thought it would be stories about men and women. But right away, as I started to write, you know, it was clear to me the women were, I was just better at writing the women, I thought. You know, I thought the women were more complex, they were more interesting to me, they were more, you know, their motivation seemed strong, but I could write them in a way where you still had some mystery to them. You know, the men were all just good. They were good boys. They were all me. And so I thought, well, you know, what I want to talk about here are these themes. It doesn't matter to me if they're men or women. So I ended up writing, you know, what was that first movie, Things You Can Tell Just by Looking at Her. And I said, okay, they're all going to be women. There's a story in there that is a couple, two young lesbian women played by Calista Flockhart and Valeria Golino. And they're living in the apartment, and one of them is sick. And that's a story that drove me nuts forever. I wrote it. It was a man and a woman. The woman was sick. The husband was not. And it just, I wrote and wrote, and it just didn't happen. It just wasn't going anywhere. Then in the winter one night, I caught a cold, and I caught bronchitis, and I had to go to the emergency room. And in the emergency room, they put me in one of these rooms, you know, that are separating by curtains. And there was this woman in the room next to me. I think she was like an older woman. And she was in pain, and she was crying and complaining and turning around. And, you know, her husband, you know, like a family member, a mother's, would go in and talk, you know. And in the end, I thought that was a guy. I thought that was a woman. And when they wheeled her out, it was a guy. And I thought, oh, a couple could be two women, couldn't it? I mean, it's not that it hadn't occurred to me, but that's the kind of thing that, you know, you're stuck with an idea and you're waiting for something to help you break through. And this person that I thought of as a guy, it's a guy. Finally, I see her walk through. I mean, I see her walk through, it's a guy. So, you know, the process was long and convoluted because it was the first thing I'd written. But, you know, anyway, I got to the end, and that was the first movie.
Discipline and drafts are part of the writing process. Here, Rodrigo Garcia answers the question, how does a writer make it work?
You know, good luck. I mean, that's you know, that's the question. I mean, you know, when you're writing, there's that first question is, does it work? And even bigger than that, there's this huge monster on your ceiling with big ugly feathers, and it's saying, who cares? You know, it's just, I mean, that's what writers, you know, I'm sure there's many writers here, that's the who cares and does it work? You know, that's the difficult thing. You don't know, but, you know, I think you have to, I mean, you ask yourself many questions that are, you know, conscious, objective, intelligent, as it were. And then you also have to have just the level of excitement. I mean, you know, sometimes when you write a scene or you have an idea for a character, that it just makes your heart beat faster. It may not be beating faster 2 days later, but if it's still beating faster 2 days later, then you know you have something. And I don't show like half scripts or synopsis or treat sometimes, but mostly I need to write a draft and rewrite it and take it until I feel I can't take it anymore. And then I'll show it like to one or two people. And then I'll come back and work a little more. Then I'll show it to a different two people, because I have a rule that I obey myself. I never ask someone to read my script twice. I think that's just, you know, you can ask your mother to read your script twice. But I, you know, when you're asking friends to do you that favor, and I myself don't do it, I'm very frank about it. You know, when young people, there's always very close friends that you work with all the time. But, you know, I usually feel, you know, if I show the script to a couple people, I get some feedback, then I show them to two other people. It's not like, you know, deep down inside, you know what areas aren't working. And someone might give you something that's new, but you don't need to then go back to that person and ask for more. You know, I find it better to do two people, rewrite, two or three people, rewrite, a couple of people. But I really, you know, it's not rare, I think. A lot of writers do this. You want to go as far as you can before you show it. Well, I'm not a disciplined writer with respect to schedule. You know, I'm a great procrastinator. And then the internet came along. I mean, for crying out loud, screw those guys. you know, I am. I mean, also bear in mind, you know, I didn't start writing till I was in my mid-30s, really. I mean, I think the sooner you start, the more you learn. There's a lot of craft aspects to the craft that you can learn. And you find how you work best and what your schedules are, what your hours are. You know, some people can write very well 2 or 3 hours very early in the morning. Other people can do, you know, the 10 hours at night. You know, I try to... Yeah, if I'm in production, it's impossible. But if I'm not in production, I try to, you know, either write every day or at least turn on the computer, look at the page and fiddle with some dialogue a little bit. But, you know, you have to be in front of it for it to happen. You know, it's not going to... If at least I'm at the computer with the pages in front of me, something could give. If I don't even turn on the computer, then it's just not going to happen. But I do write in spurts, and I have this way of writing scripts which just drives me nuts. You know, I'll have an idea and then I'll think about it and think about it and think about it without really making notes, or then I'll start writing a few notes just when the ideas are many so that I don't forget. I don't start writing till I see the whole arc of the movie, you know, beginning, middle, and end. I gotta know, often I know what the last scene is. I have to know that. Then I start writing, and invariably I write 30, 35 pages, and then I'm stuck. And I have to then, you know, I think this time it's not going to happen, but it does happen. I have to step away for it for a year or 2 years sometimes. And then I come back and I can see what... It's not by chance. I mean, you know, the second act is, you know, it's a nightmare, so... The first act is all excitement, you know, it's all introduction of things, so that's easy to write. I'm someone who needs constant distraction, and I like to read books, and I watch quality TV and crappy TV. You know, I'm a workaholic when you're shooting because it demands it. You know, that's the only thing that's happening. But other than that, I need downtime all the time. And also when I'm writing a script, I need to look at a movie about once a day. I see a movie, either new or old, mostly a movie I've seen before. I just feel like I need to feed the brain constantly about how it's done and how it's done in different ways. So when I'm really in the middle of it and writing a script, you know, I will watch either on Netflix or DVD or go to a theater. I would watch, you know, 5-6 movies a week for sure. I just need to feed the brain. You know, everyone does it. You have to do it. You know, people have things in development. I mean, right now, for example, I have a script that I wrote. I've finished it, and it's sort of sitting there. I know what I have to go back and do to it, but I'm trying to give it some time. At the same time, I'm writing a series of web series for the internet with very short chapters. And say once a week, I meet with a person with whom I'm writing a pilot. And when I meet with her, you know, as the session starts, I'm like, wow, I can't even remember what we said last week. But, you know, you get in there and you get in there. And, you know, she's also working, so I'm sure she's as worried of making a fool of herself as I am. But, yeah. And also, you know, for better or worse, maybe for worse, all these movies and series and pilots, as different as they are, they're in that field that, you know, I always come back to, which is the relationship, the family, where you belong, where you don't belong, where you'd like to belong. It's the story first, always. I mean, I love the characters and the complexities of a character, but it's always, you know, that initial spark is, you know, what is the problem? What does he or she want? What are the obstacles? And then, I, you know, as I'm writing it, developing it, thinking of it in the story terms, then the peculiarities of the character begin to form. For example, Mother and Child had two central women, a woman of 50 who at 14 had been forced to give up her baby for adoption. Didn't know who took the baby, had never met her. So I knew that was the problem. You know, already here's a woman who was forced to be separated from her baby. I knew she had grown up and probably wanted to find her daughter. you know, what the desire, the objectives and the obstacles are all there. It's when I start writing her that I start figuring out what she's like. And then I discover, well, question number one, why hasn't she looked yet? Because she's scared her daughter will reject her. So if she hasn't looked, what kind of person has that turned her into? So, you know, the initial spark is always the set of problems that launches the story. And then as you unfold the story, the question, well, who is she and how is she reacting and acting and what choices is she making? You know, the baby that was given up for adoption is a woman who is now 35 and a very successful, you know, professional. And she also, you know, she's saying, I don't care who my biological mother is, I'm not looking for her. And I always thought she was so adamant about not looking for her mother, not wanting to look for her biological mother. She was so adamant about it that immediately I thought it's a lie. And so I started building on that, you know, how everything she does in her life, you know, and the way she moves is about sustaining this lie that she doesn't need to look because she is in control of her own. In TV, I actually have not had much of this experience because all the pilots I've done, well, with the exception of In Treatment, all the pilots I've done in the series I've worked on have been written by someone else. So again, it's more of an interpreting thing and, you know, you try to bring yourself into it, but I did not generate it. I didn't even generate In Treatment. Believe me, if I had generated if I had truly created In Treatment, I would be patting myself on the back 24/7. Because, you know, it's based on an Israeli series, Betipul, and the series was so exceptional. You know, I saw 10 episodes and I thought this will work in any Western country. I just knew it could just happen. I did the pilot, which is an adaptation of the first week, the first 5 episodes. And, you know, I adapted some things, but it's, you know, it was 85% what was there. And then from week to week, it changed more. You know, we sort of, with the group of writers and the actors and directors, we sort of took it a little bit our own way. You know, it's like 3 movies, you know, when you're writing it and then when you're directing it and then when you're post-producing it. A lot of it survives, you know, even in the best, you know, in the good cases, you know, the characters may not look or talk like you imagined when you were writing them and the locations might be different and you have a certain type of music and you thought of another type, but you know, as long as along the way it still satisfies that central preoccupation that you're talking about. You know, there's always a central idea to every movie that I think, you know, I carry with me while I'm writing it, when I'm editing it, when I'm working on them. I know that even if I have no time, no money to shoot, even if this set doesn't work, even if I can only do 2 takes, I know there's this thing, this touchstone. If I can get across this central idea, then I can, you know, keep going.
Garcia takes us through the creation of his hit series, In Treatment.
Well, I mean, you know, like I said, luckily, you know, I got him almost perfectly baked. You know, when you look at a show like Betipul, the Israeli, or In Treatment, the first question I always thought was, well, why hasn't anyone done this before? And it's because it's really hard. And what the Israelis did beautifully were two, you know, I guess structural solutions. First of all, this idea that the show had to run from Monday through Friday. And that the Monday patient was always the same, the Tuesday patient was always the same. And then this idea that on Friday, the shrink goes to his shrink. Not only re-energizing everything that you saw that week, but that's something that you carry to the next week. I think once they discovered that, you know, the choice which they made, which was interesting, was the show was really about the shrink. And what they did was, we assume he sees patients all day, every day. We only follow 5 of his patients because these are the patients that are hitting a nerve with him. Each one of these patients is touching a difficult area for him. You know, it's almost embarrassing, but it took me, you know, I didn't realize till we had already started shooting that in one way or another, everyone in the show has daddy problems. That's something that, you know, the Israeli had. And I said that to the Israeli creator, and he was like, oh, really? You know, there's always an area there that even if you're doing well, you don't know you're doing. But that's what made it great, that the characters touch on his own problems. Second, the conflict is in the room. The sessions were very confrontational. The patients were always arguing with him, challenging him. So it wasn't just him listening to stuff about their day or their week. It was him having to almost defend himself. Because the patients were really putting him in tricky situations. And then with respect to casting an Irish actor, you know, we always thought, okay, who could this be? And we made a list of two or three people, four people. Gabriel was always there. You know, you wanted someone that would project a lot of intelligence, but also someone that would project a great deal of empathy, someone that you could believe his intellectual heft, but also someone very accessible, not someone that patients or the audience would feel was this, you know, heavy-duty brain that was overbearing or judgmental. In the end, we could have been Irish. I mean, you know, it doesn't... So I literally just went for that guy. You know, it was 43 episodes. Half of them were going to be on his close-up. You don't want to make that mistake.
Visual references, character, story, cinematography, and directing.
You know, I'm still writing a movie. I need to see it. I mean, sometimes I'll put, you know, actors' faces even in my office just to see them. And, you know, it's always a pipe dream, of course, because you always go for the most exciting actor you could think of. And then sometimes that fucker will turn you down. And screw her. But that hasn't happened to me. But yeah, you need all the references, you know, listen to music, like I said, read movies, just the constant, how is it done? You know, how do they do it? And I tend to go back to the same, I mean, with respect to the actors, for example, it's very important for me to nail the age of the character. You know, if I can't move forward till I know she's 35 and not 53 and not 26. And I've had agonizing nights where I know a character needs to be 37 and a 25-year-old star wants to play her. And I just, you have to say no, unless you see it in another way. But, you know, the age of a character, meaning where a person is in their life, is crucial to me. So until I find that gal or that guy who's right at this age, who's, you know, I need those references. You know, this is a conversation I have with myself all the time. For me, the idea of the likability of a character, I mean, for me, the unlikable character is the cliche, the badly written character, the character that I'm ahead of them. You know, I saw this movie, The Downfall. Do you remember the movie? It's about Hitler and his generals in that bunker. They were neither sympathetic or unsympathetic to me. They were fascinating. It was like a mental hospital down there, you know? So, I mean, on paper, I mean, if you know what Hitler is and what Hitler was, you should say, oh, it's too unsympathetic to want to see a movie with him. But, you know, and many other characters, I mean, believe me, I have this conversation, you know, I send my scripts. Every time I make a movie, some studios say, we want to make your next one. Then I send the next script, and it doesn't happen. And one of the things we have is this conversation of, are they sympathetic? You know, for me, not in my movies, but in any movie, you know, are they believable? Are they complicated? Do they surprise me? Also, do I feel for them? You know, is it heartbreaking? You know, is their bad behavior the result of a wound? You know, when you're on the street and someone does something objectionable, the first thing you say is, what is wrong with him? What is wrong with her? Well, that's always the right question. You know, that really difficult woman at the cashier, that guy who pushes people in the bus, that rude person, it's not, oh, he's rude. No, it's what's wrong with him. And I think if we feel that there's a wound there, that there's a problem, that there's something unsatisfied, then, you know, you connect because, you know, I can be that asshole at the cashier. I mean, you know, I think cinematographers get plenty credit. I mean, especially great ones and, you know, star cinematographers like, you know, Rodrigo Prieto is just, you know, he goes from one excellent movie to another. You've cornered me, so I'll answer your question. I mean, I still think that, you know, great cinematographers are fantastic, as are great actors. You know, there is this thing of the direction of the ship and the overall, you know, I don't, you know, cinematographers are great storytellers and they contribute to the story in tremendous ways. But given that they may not have been in the script phase and in the casting phase and in the editorial phase, you know, it is as wonderful as it is. It's not, it doesn't have the overview that directors have. Many of them become directors and they're good directors. But yeah, I mean, this is just whatever captures people's imagination. You know, you could argue also that, you know, the actors get disproportionate credit. I mean, they are the movies, really. You know, they are the movies. A cinematographer, a great cinematographer. I mean, it's, you know, I used to be a cinematographer, not a particularly good one, certainly not like Rodrigo Prieto. And people ask me, why don't you shoot movies yourself? Is because I'd hate to give up that other brain. You know, I'd hate to give up that, and I know, you know, a lot of directors shoot themselves, you know, shoot their own movies and shoot themselves. But, you know, I hate to give up that conversation. And also often, you know, I'd like to have work with DPs from Mexico. It just makes me feel like, you know, I have someone from the old neighborhood with me, you know, that it's not all, you know, I'm not away from home shooting in a movie in a foreign country in a foreign language. You know, just having a Mexican crony on the set keeps it all a little bit less pretentious. When push comes to shove, at least in the stuff that I write, I want those crucial moments not to be dialogue moments. So I'm always looking for that silent scene that is going to be a, you know, tell me more. Behavior, basically. Certainly dialogue is behavior. You know, what people say and what people don't say with dialogue. Again, we keep coming back to this thing of creating the great characters. What you need is the story with the great conflicts. And then you're going to have to, as you write scene by scene, you know, bring a character that's particularly well suited or badly suited, you know, to the conflicts. Am I being obtuse here? It's hard to talk about character without really, you know, going back to the story. The Prince of Denmark returns to Denmark for his father's funeral. His mother has already remarried to his uncle. That's conflict. All right. Now you start playing it out. There's so much stuff that, you know, that is there in Hamlet, indecision, is he sure, he doesn't even know who he wants to be, you know, what do I love my mother or do I hate her, do I believe what seemed to be the ghost of my father? I mean, there's a lot of there for him to be Hamlet, but already the conflicts are superb. So I don't think there's character before story somehow. Nick Kazan and Howard Rodman, who are two excellent screenwriters. I mean, I'm saying all this crap up here, and I'm trying to avoid even seeing those guys back there, because they can write. Don't look this way, goddammit.
Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast is brought to you by Austin Film Festival. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan. Today's podcast was produced and edited by Brian Ramos. For more information on the podcast, On Story, the television show, and the 20th annual Austin Film Festival, go to www.austinfilmfestival.com or www.onstory.tv.